Believe in God, old man. I believe in God and mercy and all that. But the dead are happier dead. They don't miss much here, poor devils. Hello, and welcome to episode 136 of Ribbon of Memes. 136, imagine. This is a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other shady ne'er-do-wells as masterpieces.
I am Nick, the people, really.
That was last episode. That was Battleship Potemkin. I am Nick, the innocent abroad of this film, and I am joined as ever by the mysterious and sometimes absent Roger.
Haven't you heard? I died last week.
Oh, you could have mentioned it before I turned up. This is 1949's The Third Man. We can't keep away from these black and white film noirs. This is a film noir, isn't it? We can talk about
yes.
that. Yes. But it is a film noir. Okay, good. Just checking.
Let's not have undue suspense here.
Okay, all right. This is Carol Reed's masterpiece featuring the reunification, that can't be the right word, of Orson Welles and Joseph Cotten, who had last featured together in a film which I adore, spoilers, but we haven't discussed on Ribbon of Memes, but probably will one of these days, Citizen Kane.
Mm-hmm.
But this time Orson Welles is not in the driver's seat.
Yeah, apparently he made a lot of effort to be, but was mostly prevented.
Well, it was notoriously easy to work with and easygoing, wasn't he, Orson Welles? I'm sure it was.
Just fun. Look at that smile.
Or listen to the outtakes from the Findus adverts, which are a joy to behold. If I'm feeling down, I listen to Orson Welles doing outtakes from the Findus adverts. And you should too, dear listener, if you ever feel down. It's wonderful.
Anyway.
The Third Man. This is a story set, it's a contemporary story from 1949 in the sense that that's when it's also set, or thereabouts, in post-Second World War, Vienna. Written by Graham Greene. Now, I always thought this was based on a short story by Graham Greene, but that's not quite true.
No, he got the contract or whatever it was for the script for this. He was commissioned to do that. And in order to get things in order, he put it in a form he was more familiar with, and that was the short story, and then he redeveloped that into the full script.
And I think the short story, I don't know, leaked doesn't sound right for 1949, but the short story somehow got out into the wild when it was really just meant for Graham Greene's personal head sorting outness, I gather.
Now, I must admit, when I hear Graham Greene, I tend to think of adultery and Catholic guilt as his major themes, and perhaps, fortunately, that isn't really a thing that's going on here, either of them.
Neither of those things are going on, though the behaviour here would make a lot of Catholics feel guilty. This is the story. So we have Ribbon of Memes returning actor Joseph Cotten, who we last spoke about in the big budget version of Gaslight.
And frankly, we weren't that impressed with him there, but I think here.
It's not so much his fault as we just preferred his alter ego in the earlier Gaslight. What was his name? Professor Snatch? I can't remember. No, Inspector Gadget.
Ruff.
Can't remember. Oh, Ruff. Inspector Ruff.
By the inimitable, let's face it, Frank Pettingill.
Oh, he was wonderful. And so Joseph Cotten sort of crowbarred it as a big budget love interest didn't quite work for us.
Here I think he's rather better. I mean, it's going to become clear that he is not really the protagonist of the film.
No, he's really the kind of I am the know-nothing Dumbo who is going to show you the film through my eyes. It opens with a narration that was somewhat controversial, which basically sets up the scene in post-war Vienna. Mm. And it was Carol Reed. I think the version I watched had Carol Reed, the director, reading it in kind of the jaunty manner of another chap in a pub telling you something that happened in Vienna once, which I rather like. But it was changed in a lot of, it was removed in a lot of episodes, or I think Joseph, a lot of versions of the film, or Joseph Cotten did the narration to avoid confusion, that sort of thing. But I really like this, Carol Reed doing this kind of, let me tell you what happened once in post-war Vienna, and never sort of cropping up again. But it's a lovely setup, which I was, being an RPG nerd, I was more familiar with from the Cold City role-playing game, which is a similar sort of setup in post-war Berlin. That the
I think these days we're more familiar with the idea of zones of control and such from Berlin.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, it happened here too. In practice, the British, French, American thing fairly rapidly broke down into we are a single authority. And the Soviets had their own section because they weren't going to be part of this.
Which is also a bit like what happened in Shanghai in China. So the idea is you've got these four victorious powers from the Second World War, the Russians, the French, the Americans, the British, and they all have their quota and they all have their own police, none of which really know Vienna very well, none of which speak German very well. They all kind of harmoniously keep order in the city. There's a lovely, in the opening quote, one of the reasons I like the Carol Reed opening quotes, and I don't know how it was when it was Joseph Cotten, but when, you know, it has the lovely juxtaposition of him saying, oh, there's a lot of black market activity, amateurs, you know, but they couldn't hold the course quite as well as the professionals. At the same time, we cut to a body floating in the river in Vienna. It's in the Danube, presumably. It's a nice juxtaposition of a narration and images that tells you this film perhaps has a little more about it. It's sometimes confusing watching black and white films because I guess we forget they range from like a 30, 40, 50 year period, that the late, you know, the ones in the late 40s, the 50s are often a bit more sophisticated in a number of ways, in the narrative style and the camera style. So sometimes it can wrong foot you a bit seeing a black and white film and then finding these more sophisticated narrative techniques.
I've recently been trying to pick up the ukulele a bit, and I look at popular music from the 1920s in particular, and my goodness, this was demanding. I mean, I have way more respect than I realised I should have before for the guys who are playing this stuff. Whereas your 60s, there are some twiddly bits occasionally, but in general, it's much simpler.
Oh, absolutely. Now, this The Third Man, of course, has its famous and very distinctive zither-based soundtrack, which is not illiberally sprinkled throughout the entire film. And if you've never seen The Third Man, you've probably heard music from it, at least. If you've never seen The Third Man, probably go and watch it before you listen to us talk about it very much further.
So the single was number one in the UK. I don't know how long it was there. 11 weeks.
This is like the Harry Lyme theme, I guess. Which
the Third Man theme, technically, but yeah.
Yes.
11 weeks at number one in the US. It made Anton Karas an international star. Not really obvious why. I mean, it's good. It hits the right mood. I suspect a lot of it is in this era when, you know, the only way you could see the film was by going to see the film, but you could take the record home with you.
I agree with you. It's interesting. Maybe it's because it has become so well known that it feels a bit kind of, what's so exciting about that? But it is. It's very distinctive and slightly exotic to a lot of it. You know, a zither's not a common instrument you hear. But I agree with you. It's not immediately clear why it became so famous, but it did, and I certainly don't object to it. It's not jazz after all, so I'm quite happy with it. Moving on from the famous
jazz
soundtrack.
Man.
No, it really isn't. this is the story of Joseph Cotten's character, a failed well, not quite fail, but is he down on his luck novelist, I suppose, would you call it? He's he needs the money anyway, so he has come to Vienna at the invitation. Sorry, this is Holly. What's his surname? Holly Martins. No one gets his name right for the whole film, so it's fine, doesn't matter. They get it wrong as well. Holly Martins, writer of pretty subpar Western potboilers, as far as we can tell, has arrived in Vienna at the behest of his old chum, Harry Lime, who has got some business opportunities for him. We think. I'm not sure.
He's explicitly offered him a job.
Yes.
He hasn't said what the job is, but he's definitely offered it.
Problem is, he turns up at old Harry's apartment to be told that Harry's funeral is on in an hour or so, and they've just taken the coffin away.
So he run over in the street, very sad.
Yeah, terrible. He's told this by the doorman. Goes to the funeral. And the film develops from there, really. We have all the principal characters start to be introduced. The mourners include Alida Valli, who is a gorgeous Italian actress. We have the gorgeous, of course, Trevor Howard, who is a popular actor of the era, but as a policeman in a very fetching kind of leather... he looks like a member of the SS, to some other, more like a member of the Gestapo, I should say, but in this leather kind of trench coat of the era.
Brother Mark's coat, he said anachronistically.
Okay.
And of course, his assistant, Sergeant Payne.
Oh, the line. Now, it took me forever to work out where
that's
Sergeant
a familiar
Payne...
face, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. That's one of those where you're like, who's... of course, it is M from the James Bond films, as he became much later well-known.
Bernard Lee, at this stage of his career, was pretty much typecast as a solid, reliable guy. Much like, I mean, he played a lot of policemen, military officers, you know, people you can trust to be exactly what they appear to be and nothing more. And indeed, that's what he is here, but he's rather, rather fine.
He's, so he goes home, with the police. Well, he doesn't go home. He goes and gets drunk with the policeman. This is Holly goes along with, Payne and, Calloway. That is Trevor Howard and Bernard Lee. At this point, I don't know, something about the dialogue and the cinematography, at this point, I just trust the film because it's just the dialogue kind of, it zings not in a, not that there's anything wrong with Billy Wilder, but not in a kind of Billy Wilder way, but in a kind of a real, kind of cynical, we've all been here, we've just been through the war, that was shit, wasn't it? Let's not do that again. It just, it feels to me straight away like there's so much, you can read so much into the characters by just the way they're acted, including Joseph Cotton, and it's probably... perhaps, I don't know if that's too much on the actors as complimentary, but it all works. The style and straight away, you know, we were just talking in our last episode about Battleship Potemkin and how it worked, even though it was largely static images. But by this stage, you know, 25 years later, they're really starting to, and obviously it was Citizen Kane that pushed a lot of this, but they're really starting to master these kind of, shots where you're kind of panning over the characters or you're moving towards them, or there's a lot more motion in the story, and it just the problem with this sort of film is when it's done very well, I just kind of absorb it and don't really remember the cinematography.
Well, I think some of it is deliberately. And standing in the hotel lobby, we meet Calloway, yes. But we also we've had Calloway already.
We've
at the
met
funeral.
Him before at the funeral. We have the marvelous Wilfred Hyde White, who always livens up a film.
Yes, and it's just splendid to see as the he's obviously desperately trying to get a bit of culture into this place and failing dismally. But you write a bit. I've never heard of you, but you can give us a lecture.
Oh, we have the lovely bit of dialogue when he was like, for last week we had, for instance, and Bernard Lee pops in with the strippers, sir. And he's like, oh, yes, the Hindu dancers. Just very nicely done. It was good. Or striptease.
Always great to see. But also on the basis of getting this lecture, he's prepared to put up Martins for a few days.
Yes, so he is now not cast out from Vienna, because he didn't have any money, which is why he was coming to Vienna in the first place. But his friend is dead. The police officers basically advise him to get out of Dodge very quickly, to make like one of his Western characters. Not one of those that shoots everyone. The other thing, the sense of place here, and it doesn't do anything like quite so crass as slowly pan across, you know, shattered Vienna and show you all just the backdrop of everywhere. The end. It's this combination of history and ruin, and you know, you can see that, you know, there's just piles of rubble everywhere and burnt out cars in pits that just haven't been moved yet because we're that close to the end of the war. But then we have these, you know, these marvelous old. It gives you a kind of sense of decay and ruin and history altogether, which is probably Vienna itself. I'm presuming it was shot on location in Vienna. If not, they did a great job of making it look like Vienna. But
they did use the studios in the city, and they did some more in Isleworth and Shepperton. But
probably
six weeks on location, so.
Yeah, and they really used it well, because it just it gives this kind of sense, and the characters all have this kind of sense of kind of ruin and decay and cynicism, and but also, you know, not like a post-apocalyptic, oh, what's the point? They're all just kind of in shock about what just happened, and they're kind of recovering from it.
Meanwhile, the chap's got to eat, so.
Yeah, exactly, so let's see what we can do. So you really get this sense of why the black market is thriving here.
Of the things I like about it is, yeah, we've got Calloway, we've got Crabbin, we've got Baron Kurtz, who, oh, I was a friend of Harry's, yes. And so Martins is being confronted with all these people, each of whom clearly wants something.
Yes.
And maybe it's just what they appear to want, and maybe it's something much more sinister, and he's just not equipped to deal with this.
Well, straight away he says it. You know, he's been told by Calloway that Harry Lyme was a wrong'un, and he was a black marketeer. And he just, you know, straight away leaps to the defence of his friend, and he's wondering what the ulterior motive of these police is. And then the Baron, he's quite rightly, because it's a noir film, he's not really trusting anyone or believing anything anyone says, and starts to do a bit of digging of his own. Almost accidentally at first, but some of the stories about Harry's death don't quite add up. Some people say he was instantly dead. No one could live. Like, look at his head. It was pulp. I'm paraphrasing it. It's much better described than that. Whereas other people are saying, oh, well, just before he died, he said that he wanted you to look after him.
Remember my old mate, Ollie.
Yes, exactly. So it just doesn't quite add up. So we have this mystery set up where he's doing a bit of digging. Clearly people don't want him to do the digging. They don't quite do anything as crass as, like, threatening him. The closest people who come to threatening him are the police, basically just keep buying him airplane tickets and telling him to get on it. But even there, they're not like, they don't duff him. Oh, that's not true. Actually, Bernard Lee punches him in the face, but he's very matter of fact about it.
Yes, it's splendid. I mean, yeah, you just took a shot at my captain. I'm going to prevent you, and I'm going to stop you from doing it again. Mind how you go, sir.
Yeah, mind it. But I think Bernard Lee is one of the joys of this. But he's just I know it's kind of a British stereotype, but he's just absolutely.
That is pretty much the stereotype I use when playing low-ranking military people.
He's just utterly reliable. He kind of knows everything. Like, even when they're in the sewers, he's like, oh, yes, sir, this is... he just tells him, like, the history of the Viennese sewers.
And he is the one person in Vienna who has heard of Holly Martins and is a fan of his writing.
Yes, exactly. And is a fan of him. But he's quite happy to punch him out if he dares to do anything to his commanding officer. Equally, that's not going to affect the fact that he's a fan of his work. And it's just... beautifully played as this kind of, not even deadpan really, because he's not deadpan so much as just exactly what you see is what you get. He's just completely honest. He is one of the joys of this film. I think he's probably my favourite character in it. He's which is a shame because he's the one that doesn't make it through to the end. But it turns out there is a reason we have an unusual difference of stories between these characters, because Carrie isn't dead. And we discover that. So, well, we should probably talk about... we should probably talk about Alida Valli in this, because we have this sort of love story which could be kind of crowbarred in. We have Harry's girlfriend, who is devastated. She's a performer, an actress, a singer.
Yeah, comic actress.
And Holly, of course, falls in love with her. But what I like about the way this is played is that it's kind of doomed from the start. How did you put it when we were off air?
Well, it's doomed from the start, and she knows it.
Yes.
And he doesn't.
Yeah, he is like this lost puppy, feeling like, you know, we both loved Harry, but, you know, I love you now. And she's never really... There's some attraction to him. It's really well played. She's obviously slightly attracted to him, but he's never going to be Harry Lyme. And just... It's just beautifully done. She is a wonderful actress. I haven't seen her in anything else, but she's wonderful. She was in a lot of other things. I just haven't seen her in anything else. Is it Anna in the film? I've forgotten.
Yeah.
But she's just, I think she's just credited as Valli rather than even her full name. But she's one. So we have this, what could feel like a crowbarred in love story. Except that it isn't really. It's shot through with the same kind of decay and resignation and shock and cynicism as the whole rest of the film. So it kind of fits in.
Yeah, I was getting a strong feeling of, well, what I think of, because I'm a degenerate modern person, is Cabaret.
The
musical, which is obviously based on I Am a Camera, the play, which is based on the thing that actually existed when this film was made, Goodbye to Berlin, Isherwood's... memoir, he calls it. But yeah, any memoir that portrays Christopher Isherwood as an innocent is
Well, in Cabaret, he gets less issues. So this is so basically we have Holly here as the Michael York character in Cabaret.
Yeah, he's very much the I'm just going to take things as they come, and obviously everything is what it appears to be, and everything is fine, and he's just not really equipped to deal with. No, actually, it isn't. Maybe the Baron is not a good person.
That's a very good... I hadn't really compared that to it, but it's this kind of innocent abroad. Not quite innocent, but really too naive for their own good abroad. But proxy for the audience in the sense that you're going to have things explained to you in very simple words, aren't you?
Though also, I think Westerns in the popular image at the time would have been... You know, you've got good guys in white hats and bad guys in black hats.
Yes.
And I think there's a lot of that in Holly's view of the world as well. He's expecting to be able to tell by looking at them who's a good guy and who's a bad guy. You're opposed to my friend.
Good guy.
You're opposed to my friend who is a good guy, therefore you must be a bad guy.
Yeah, you're idiots. You clearly don't know what's going on, and I'm going to get to the bottom of it. So get to the bottom of it he does, because Harry... turns up. I mean, the entrance, again, this is one of the most famous scenes in cinema, which has been set up by the fact that, the cat only loved Harry, and then the cat runs down the alley. And this is where it really, I don't know, noir, this is noir really in the technical sense of the use of light and shadow in this film is astonishing. And Harry Lyme's entrance in that Viennese doorway, and then the window opens at just the appropriate time to illuminate Orson Welles' face. And that kind of cheeky grin, it's just an incredible entrance. The cat runs to his feet, and then we have the Harry Lyme music in the background. That is a cinematic entrance that, I feel cinema can do that in a way that no other medium can really. That is a good moment in cinema.
Yeah, being able to have no words but still carry on doing things.
So it turns out Harry is alive, and it's interesting from this point really that the kind of mystery sort of dissolves in the sense it's never really then further. It's never really explicitly explained what happened. I mean, you can piece it together. Obviously, what they did was murder this poor orderly at the hospital and put him in the coffin, and Harry was one of the people carrying it. But it's never, at that point, the kind of the mystery kind of fades away into the background, and it becomes about catching Harry.
Well, also Holly's personal dilemma, because he started off thinking Harry is my friend, Harry is a good guy. He is told by the police, this guy was a black marketeer, and then later he was stealing penicillin. And then later still, what I wrote down as the is convinced by the evidence montage.
Yes.
Where he's clearly being shown all the documentary proof of, no, this guy was stealing it, this guy was diluting it and then selling it as if it were full strength.
So, yes, what he's been doing, his racket is you can get a ton of money for black market penicillin. You can get a ton more money if you dilute it down and sell 10 bottles instead of the one bottle that you had to start with. But that's not great if you've got meningitis and you're a kid and you're trying to get the right dose of penicillin, which Holly never really kind of goes for. But then he meets Harry again in another one.
Well,
of those
as I see it, he's convinced by that evidence and he agrees, yeah, all right, we need to catch this guy. Then he meets Harry, and it's that thing that, you know, Charles II was like this. He'd always agree with the last person who'd advised him.
Thankfully, we have no people like that nowadays in modern politics.
And so he meets Harry, and then okay, I mean, Wells as hard to work with is a cliche, but I think he does a very good job here of portraying someone who is both trying to trade on the old friendship and clearly breaking down a bit.
Yes, you get the sense that he was much more charming, but that's cracked a bit because he's in real shit. And so he kind of bounces around in this whole Ferris wheel trip. He kind of bounces around from false friendship to almost open threats to kind of, come on, we were all friends. It's really well done. That whole scene, which again, probably Orson Welles had a great deal to do with. And then you realize what an absolute bastard he is, you know, when he's like, you know, would it really bother you if any of those little dots down there stop moving forever? How about if I offered you 20 grand for every one that stopped moving? Again, I'll grant you Orson Welles delivers that better than I did. But it's the scene where not only you get the feeling that he'd never be quite as crass as that if he wasn't so desperate, but it's the scene where Holly sort of starts to realise, has our whole friendship been a total sham, and have I been taken as a fool this whole time? It's a nice scene. And then, of course, we have the very famous scene at the bottom where Orson Welles talks about... it almost does feel a bit like Orson Welles here, just showing off a bit with the cuckoo clock, which has become one of the most famous speeches in cinema, which I like, but it's certainly not my favourite bit of dialogue in the film. The rest of the dialogue is beautiful, particularly when Bernard Lee's involved with it. But yeah, we sort of go on the journey with Holly from, no, these police are idiots, to actually the police have been right the whole time. The only thing they're kind of wrong about is that Harry Lyme was dead, but everything else they've said is true.
Yeah. And they had a reason for being on his trail, and,
We get the interesting, as you say, he's convinced by the facts montage, not quite convinced enough to betray his friend. But then you get the quite manipulative stop off at the hospital, and he's just like, oh, maybe. And it's interesting, you never see the effects of Harry's diluted penicillin, but you see the effects of that on Holly's face, and that's nicely played. That's good. That's a good bit of cinema.
So, we've also got the complication that Anna is not quite what she appears to be. She is, was it Czech? Anyway, somewhere that is now...
She's somewhere that the Russians can now say, no, you're one of ours now, love. On you come. And so, in his gallant fashion, Holly decides, I'm going to save the girl, and I'll probably get the girl if I do this as well. And she'll realise what a bastard Harry was all along. And that doesn't...
I'm not sure he's thinking that clearly.
No, but he wants to sort of, in a way, I don't know, it's nice that you can spread, but he feels a bit tainted and dirty by his association with Harry and probably wants to do something good and rescue the girl. Girl doesn't want to be rescued, particularly not by Holly.
She's prepared to take the ticket.
Yes.
Until she realises that it's Holly who paid for it, or arranged it.
And she doesn't want his pity. And particularly when she works out the only way you could have got this ticket is basically by betraying Harry. Which he has done by this point. But she refuses to leave the city, and Holly decides to go home, but then is taken to the hospital and shown the effects of Harry's
Somebody else has talked to you since the last time we spoke. Let me just remind you.
Holly, it's an interesting character. I mean, he's a similar... I do really like Joseph Cotton. And he's really good in Citizen Kane. I need to get you to watch Citizen Kane at some point. But he's very good here at playing the kind of the idiot, in a way. The fool, perhaps, is kinder. He's not unintelligent, but he's so easily swayed and so manipulative, so manipulative. You can see how Harry Lime's done it all these years.
Yeah.
You can see Trevor Howard's character working out, oh, no, wait, these are the pushings. These are the buttons I need to push to get this guy to work for me. It's very good. Then we have this more... I suppose the ending of the film is a bit of a letdown slightly because, well, not the whole ending. It feels like we have a very long sequence to me of people running around sewers. Well, Orson Welles running around sewers with other shots of, German troops or Viennese troops, I suppose.
Yeah, Orson Welles is mostly in Shepperton. The rest of it was filmed in the actual sewers.
It just seems like there's a lot of shots telling me the same thing, that, oh, he's nearly got caught.
Oh, that's interesting. Or... I got a different impression because to me it was how to make a chase, particularly a sewer chase, visually interesting. Because I think the default on a sewer is, okay, you got a pipe, you know, you go in one end, you come out the other end. And here we've got all these archways and junctions, and here's a bit where you have to go down some stairs and then duck under where you were before, and waterfalls and all that sort of thing.
Yes, I agree. And the lighting, this is a proper noir film, and the shadows and everything. We haven't talked about like the shadows on the. I'm not qualified to talk about the lighting and the appearance, but I agree. Visually, it's interesting. He tried one too many manholes for me. You know, he climbs up a ladder and there's someone there. Okay, all right. Oh, he's done it again. 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 And there's a lot of times when he climbs up a ladder and tries to get out and he can't. But maybe I'm just a naturally impatient person. But I felt slightly weary of the sewer by the end of it.
No, fair enough.
But that's me. But then it does absolutely tragically end with the shooting. I'm going to say not fatal shooting of Payne, Bernard Leeds' reliable sergeant, trying to, in his wonderful way, trying to save Joseph Cotton, who once again is being a bit of an idiot. A fool. and gets Payne killed, for which I'll never forgive him. Except Payne doesn't die. He lives happily after that. He's fine. Just looks dead. But then, again, this bit is really nicely done. It's interesting. I'm not sure a modern police officer would just be like, I'm going to stay with my guy. You go after the quarry. Make sure to take your gun and shoot him first if you see him. Doesn't feel very police officery, but I suppose he's...
Well, be so much less paperwork that way.
Exactly. There would be a lot of paperwork nowadays for that sort of stuff. But Harry has already been injured, and Holly kills him.
I think... He actually invites it. He tries to get out through one last grating and he just can't get the hatch open. And Holly is caught up with him and he basically gestures to say, yeah, go ahead, shoot. Cause, you know, at least it ends at that point. He's not going to have to rot in prison or whatever.
I still think he was trying one last trick.
Probably.
It doesn't work though. Harry gets killed and, It's nice. The nice bit then is the film ends with the second funeral of Harry Lime, but it's actually got Harry Lime in the coffin at this point. And then once again, it ends up with Holly basically not having learned a great deal from the whole experience. He still thinks he's going to get the girl at the end. Now, I gather in the Graham Greene story, so he stops somewhere. He's been driven to the airport. And he thinks, no, I'm gonna stop and wait for Anna, and it'll all work out. And the wonderful ending of the film is she just basically walks past him and ignores him out of the film and out of his life. That is a difference to the film, to the Graham Greene story.
This is where I realise just how superb Reed is at building and releasing tension, because that shot is set up. You know, she's walking in from the middle distance.
Mm.
Up the road directly towards the camera, and Holly is just off to the side. And there's this tension, what's she going to do getting closer, what's she going to do? And she just keeps going.
Exactly, she just walks out of the film, and in very kind of 50s male style, you just resign to it. Like, he is now like everyone else, he's kind of dazed, depressed, recovering, he lights up a cigarette, and... the film ends.
But that was what I realised, that a lot of the rest of it had been carefully setting up, you know, building and releasing tension.
Mm, yeah.
It's not something I normally notice, but a shot like that just does it so thoroughly that can't help it.
I agree. That for me, unlike the sewer scene, which I will not complain about too much, but this is just perfectly timed and just well enough done that the kind of... And releasing tension in the same kind of way of, ugh.
The thing that struck me, I mean, I've seen fragments of this before. Mm. And obviously it's well known for, you know, the Dutch angles and the big menacing shadows and stuff like that. But watching the whole thing, it became much clearer to me that is being gradually built up as things get weirder and more out of control.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Rather than just, oh, well, we're going to do this for the whole film, as in, oh, Event Horizon, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I agree, from, like, building up to, you know, the appearance of Harry Lime in the doorway and those kind of angles, and then the whole kind of sewer section is all that kind of stuff. I've got to stop trying to say that word.
in the film, like...
In the film, it's just visually, it's just beautiful. I mean, the contrast, the images, there's a reason, you know, some of the scenes of this film are some of the most famous, much like in Potemkin, as we talked about in our last episode. But here, I don't know. So what I said about Potemkin was that was a film that was... I admired, but it was hard to love, and I wasn't sure I actually even liked that much. The Third Man is kind of the opposite, well, not the opposite, in that all three work for me. I admire it as a piece of art. As a narrative, it's brilliant, and just as a story, it's a great story.
Yeah, when I was reading about the film before we did this, I discovered that there were a couple of series that came after it. There was a radio series, The Adventures of Harry Lime, with Orson Welles. And there were five seasons of TV series 10 years later. And
now,
both
you
of
could
these...
say this was Orson Welles selling out, but he had Transformers the movie in his future. So maybe
but,
not.
Both of these are basically the adventures of the cheerful rogue Harry Lime.
Isn't that missing the point a bit, really? That
well,
he's
yes.
Actually and a complete... This is... It's almost like...
But
the way I would have to rationalise that in what you call headcanon is that actually this is Holly writing down the stories of his cheerful rogue friend Harry Lime and cheerfully ignoring the reality of what an absolute bastard Harry Lime is.
Yeah, thinking about it from there, it occurs to me that, you know, say you've got this hugely successful film and you want to do a spin-off. You can't really do The Further Adventures of Holly Martins. He's not the sort of man who has further adventures in his future. This
no.
This is it.
The further adventures of Harry Lime were a bit hard because he's in the ground, but they went for the earlier adventures.
I mean, you could do the Calloway and Payne investigate show. That could be great fun.
In fact, I
want to run that as a campaign now.
That would be incredible. They are the best. Calloway is a great character. How did you put it when we were talking off air about Calloway?
Well, look at this in terms of noir. This does break some of the classic noir rules, as a lot of them do. But he is, and I think this might be why it didn't become a series. He is simply the honest cop who is exactly what he appears to be, just the same as Payne is.
Yes, exactly. Everything he says, he's not trying to, he manipulates Holly because Holly's eminently manipulable, but he's not got any other agenda than the agenda he says right at the start of the film. Harry Lime's a bastard, and as soon as he finds out he's still alive,
let's see if we can fix that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
So I think you couldn't really start the story early, you couldn't re-end it later. I think in some ways that's a sign of good economy of storytelling. You've got everything that is important to the story is right here. Yes. And you can't really add to it.
Yeah, even the love story works in the context that it is. And in a way, you know, remember the last time we saw Joseph Cotton, we really felt that the Gaslight implied love story between him and the principal character in Gaslight, which was there played by, my memory's failing me, wonderful Casablanca actress.
Ingrid Bergman.
Thank you. There it really did feel crowbarred in and actually, frankly, a bit creepy and weird.
Mm.
But here it's just, it's not even really a love story. It just fits in with the general milieu.
It feels like the sort of thing that Harry would do. Sorry, that yes. That Holly would do.
I like the way you've called him Harry, just as Anna does the whole way through the film, because that's who she's thinking about the whole time. It's good. I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb and call this a masterpiece.
Yeah. I think. Also, in terms of influence, Vienna as a setting for Cold War shenanigans was obviously going to happen because it's easier to get to than Berlin.
Right, yes.
But I think this was certainly one of the influences that caused it to be a setting that people chose for their spy stories.
Yeah, it's certainly a big espionage location now, yes.
And exactly. And the Wiener Riesenrad obviously is a big obvious landmark that you can go on as well.
Yes.
I turned up in before Sunrise.
Oh, it did, didn't it? One of those before film. I think it was before Sunrise. Yeah, the first one.
I think I first became aware of it in The Living Daylights, James Bond films.
Yes, so. Yeah. I mean, the film, the music became, you know the music, even if you don't know the film. You might not think, oh, that's from one of the most famous films of all time. It's visually, you know, some of the scenes in it, the cuckoo clock, the appearance of Harry Lime, I think even the sewer scene have all been considered massively famous and very influential, or at least parodied. They tried to make sequel series of it as well. And I feel like it influenced a whole generation of younger filmmakers as well to make films like this. It's and quite right too. It's good.
Yeah, I mean, as far as noir goes, we were saying earlier that this wasn't really this doesn't have the man who is unafraid, except in a parodic sense.
No,
who is not himself mean.
Our classic character for that would be Sam Spade, and there isn't really. Sam Spade lives in that world from the Maltese Falcon, but he lives in that world, but he's distant from it. He's not corrupted by it in quite the same way.
Mm.
Whereas Holly is just a complete innocent. I think even Calloway said to him at one point, "You were born to be murdered." You know, he really comes across as that kind of character. The closest to that would be Calloway, I suppose, who is horrified by this world and isn't corrupted by it. So we do have those characters here, but they're not really the focus of the film.
And to be fair, I think, after the war in particular, that sort of shiny hero went out of fashion quite sharply. In terms of what people now knew about what people will do.
Yeah, that cast a lot of worrying light on humanity. But it's beautifully, not quite cynical. I mean, I'll just go on about this film or not. But it's a good one.
Yeah,
like one of my favourites.
I'll go along with that.
All right. Well, there we are. I will point out that the famous cuckoo clock. I don't think the Swiss invented cuckoo clocks, and I don't think they had 500 years of peace and brotherly love. I think they had some pretty abhorrent regimes, not least the horrible regime from Mad Heidi, which we have seen in the future.
When did women get the vote again?
Yeah, exactly. So Swiss is not exactly utopian. Switzerland is not exactly utopian. But it's a very well-delivered scene, because it's awesome.
Really, I think all that remains to say is next time we'll have a foolproof coffin.